expressed sympathy for the unfortunate patient. Eventually the men departed with a chorus of hearty farewells. Ethan discovered that his other arm had stolen around Garrett. Making himself let go of her was like trying to uncoil a steel spring.
"You should go up to your father now," he said with difficulty.
"Eliza will look after him while I take a few minutes to show you some slides. I have insect wings, pollen grains, flower petals. What would you like to see?"
"The inside of a hansom cab," he said softly. "I can't be alone with you, darling."
Garrett touched the edges of his vest, fingers clamping on the thin leather. "Ethan." A blush rose in her face, like light glowing through pink frosted glass. "I don't want to end this. We could meet in secret now and then. No one would have to know. We would make no claims on each other. We'll just do as we please." The way she fumbled with the words, so unlike her usual precise way of speaking, devastated Ethan. He could only guess what it cost her to lay open her pride like this. He wasn't certain what she was offering, or even if she knew. Not that it mattered. He wanted, craved, needed anything she was willing to give, but he had to make her understand that it was impossible. And even if it were, the idea was beneath her.
"Have you had that kind of arrangement with a man before?" he brought himself to ask.
Her eyes were the green of deep summer and lush growing things. "I'm a woman who makes her own decisions and handles the consequences."
"That means no," Ethan said softly.
At her silence, he continued,
"You'd be risking your reputation, your career."
"Believe me, I understand that better than you."
"Have you ever shared a bed with a man, even once?"
"Why is that relevant?"
Her evasive response sent a pleasure pang down to the pit of his stomach. "That means no," he said again, his voice even softer than before.
He took a slow breath, trying to steady himself, while his blood sang with the knowledge that she'd been waiting for him. She was meant to be his. God, he wanted her beyond any reckoning of earth or heaven. But her well-being mattered 1,000 times more than his own desires.
"Garrett, I'm a man full of trouble. When I vowed to let nothing harm you, I included myself on that list."
A frown crimped her forehead. She closed her grip on his vest until her fists were tight as pine knots. "I'm not afraid of you or your trouble." Her green eyes were narrowed and intent as she tugged him closer. "Kiss me," she urged in a whisper.
"I have to go," he said shortly, and
pulled back while he was still able. But Garrett moved with him, her hands reaching up to grip his head on either side, the way he taught her at Beaujart's. The strength of her fingers electrified him. "Kiss me," she commanded, "or I'll break your nose." The threat startled a ragged laugh from him. He shook his head as he looked at her, this fearsomely capable woman who loved geese and was afraid of spaghetti and could either wield a scalpel in a complex surgical procedure or use it as a throwing knife. There had always been a cold streak in him, but he couldn't seem to find it now when he needed it most. He was breaking apart inside. He would never be the same after this.
"Christ, you've ruined me," he whispered.
His arms went around her, one hand gripping the heavy silken mass of her braided chignon. She guided his head down, and he lost the battle. All his will vanquished, as he began to kiss her as if the world were about to end.
For him, it was.
Chapter 8. In truth, the kiss started a bit awkwardly. Garrett puckered her lips into an innocently round shape, as if she were pressing them against someone's cheek. Had Ethan not been so inflamed, he would have smiled. He brushed his mouth over the garnered circle of her lips, playing softly, coaxing without words.
"Like this?"
nudging at her lips until she parted them hesitantly. All the hungering minutes of his life, the years of bitter struggle, had led to this moment. The scars his soul had worn like armour were dissolving at her touch, She allowed the gentle intrusion of his tongue, made a little sound of pleasure, and to his eternal delight, she tried to pull him deeper. The graceful hands he so admired lifted to his head, slender fingers wandering behind his ears and into his hair, and the feel of it was so exquisite he all but purred. The kiss turned into something dark and dreaming, an unspoken language of heat and silk, tenderness and greed. He was so famished for her, had worshipped and wanted her for so long, but he'd never expected to have her in his arms. He'd never imagined she would yield to him like this, her response natural and searing. Nothing had ever devastated him the way she did. He pulled her closer, as if he were trying to protect her with his entire body, and she moaned softly, clinging to him as her knees began to give out like slip-joint hinges. Lifting her easily, Ethan sat her on the edge of a metal table and collected her against him, one of his hands guiding her head to his shoulder. She conformed to him bonelessly, her legs forced to part beneath her skirts. Her breath came in flutters, like the bursts of a sparrow's wing beats.
"Take her right now,"
came the lust-drenched thought. He could make her want it. He could have her begging for it, right there on the table. It would feel so damn good, better than anything either of them had ever experienced. It would be worth anything.
"Don't trust me,"
he managed to warn, unsteadily. Garrett's breath struck his neck in a little puff of amusement. "Why," she whispered, "are you going to seduce me in my own laboratory?" Clearly she had no idea how close he was to doing just that. Ethan crushed his mouth against her smoothed back hair, his gaze wandering over shelves filled with vaguely menacing instruments and flasks of mysterious fluids.
"What man couldn't be carried away in a setting like this?"
he asked dryly, although there actually was something provocative about it, this scientific room of cold, hard surfaces, and the pretty green-eyed creature in his arms. She was the only soft thing in here.
"Science is romantic," Garrett agreed dreamily, missing the sarcasm.
"There are secrets and wonders waiting to be discovered in this laboratory." Ethan's lip twitched as he charted the length of her spine with his palm.
"The only wonder I see is you, Akushla."
Garrett drew back enough to look at him, the tip of her nose brushing his.
"What does that word mean?"
"Akushla? It's a word for female friend."
After a moment of consideration, a sceptical grin crossed her face.
"No, it isn't."
It was pure reflex to kiss her again, a response to an impulse before it had even reached his brain. Her mouth shaped to his with a willingness that drew a primitive grunt of satisfaction from his throat. He felt the innocent tightening of her thighs against his hips, and his groin pumped with heat. Ethan damned himself as his fingers went to the buttons of her basque. Just a few minutes more, and he would live on it to the end of his days. The front of her bodice fell open to reveal a chemise fastened with a tiny silk bow, and a simple white corset with elastic panels, the kind women wore for riding or exercise. With great care, he untied the little bow and ran his forefinger inside the loosened chemise. As the back of his knuckle brushed her breast, a rush of intense excitement made it difficult to breathe. He eased the fine white cotton down to reveal a soft pink nipple peeking over the moulded corset edge. He bent over her, compelling her to lean back on his arm, and slipped his fingers beneath the boned fabric to lift the firm, silky weight of her breast. His head lowered. Taking the rosy tip into his mouth, he tugged it into a stiff bud. She gasped and trembled, her hand gripping his shoulder repeatedly, like a cat kneading her paws. For Ethan, the sexual act had always been a transaction or a weapon. He'd been trained in the arts of seducing anyone, man or woman, into yielding their most closely guarded secrets. He knew endless ways to stimulate, torment, and satisfy, how to make someone mindless with desire. He'd done things, and had things done to him, that most people would consider beyond decency. But he'd never experienced anything like the intimacy of this moment. He spread a path of slow kisses to her other breast, taking his time, savouring the unbelievable smoothness of her skin. As his lips reached the edge of her chemise, Garrett fumbled to pull the garment down. Even as aroused as Ethan was, he grinned briefly at her impatience. Cupping beneath her breast, he kissed the pale curve, deliberately avoiding the pink centre. Her fingers slid into his hair as she tried to guide his mouth to where she wanted it. He resisted, blowing gently against the contracted point. Garrett quivered in frustration as he hovered over the nipple for a torturously long moment, making them both wait. Finally, relenting, he caught the firm bud, pulled it deep, teased it with his tongue. That was all he could stand before he had to pull his mouth away. She strained upward to kiss him, but he shook his head and held her off. He'd never been so aroused, his flesh so hard that every throb of his pulse hurt. "I have to stop," he said hoarsely, now, while he still could. Her arms crept around his neck. "Stay with me tonight." Filled with lust and yearning, Ethan nuzzled her flushed cheek.
"Ah, darling," he whispered, "you don't want that. I wouldn't be nice. I'd bring you to the edge of wanting and keep you there till you were cursing and screaming your pleasure for all the neighbours to hear, and after I'd brought you to a long, hard come. I might turn you over my knee for being such a noisy lass. Is that what you want? To spend all night in bed with a big, mean bastard?"
Her voice was muffled against his shoulder.
"Yes."
A laugh stirred in his throat. Her legs dangled from her seated position on the table. White cotton stockings, sensible walking boots. The way she sat with her thighs parted should have made her appear wanton, but instead the posture reminded him of a young tomboy. He couldn't believe she would make herself so vulnerable to him. He leaned forward, his mouth finding hers. She quivered and opened for him, letting him taste her. The finely wrought muscles of her leg tensed as she realized his hand had stolen beneath her skirts and was working up her thigh. Even the most demurely styled ladies' drawers were constructed with a long slit at the crotch. While the garments were perfectly modest while a woman was in a standing position, they opened completely when she was seated. Reaching the seamed edge of the gap, he let his thumb rest gently against the delicate skin of her inner thigh. Garrett pulled her mouth from his and buried her face in his throat. Ethan tightened his arm around her back while his thumb slid higher, circling into the edge of a silky rough patch of hair. He skimmed the tops of the curls, stirring the hairs with teasing strokes that awakened vague echoes of sensation at the roots. Gently he murmured in the hollow space just behind her earlobe, guessing at what might excite or intrigue her.
"In India, before a man marries, he's taught how to please his wife according to ancient texts on the erotic arts. He learns about the embraces, kisses, strokes, and bites that bring fulfillment."
"Bites?"
she asked, dazedly.
"Love bites, darling. Nothing that would hurt you."
To demonstrate, he bent to her neck and nibbled softly. She made an agitated sound and arched toward him.
"'Tis said the joining of two who are well matched is a high union," he whispered. "And if they become so intoxicated by love as to leave faint marks on the skin, their passion for each other will not be lessened even in 100 years.
Garrett's voice was wobbly.
"Did you learn any of these erotic arts?"
His lips curved against her skin.
"Aye, but I'm still novice. I only know 120 positions.
100 and...
She broke off, as he let two fingers slide gently between the soft lips of her sex, teasing back and forth. After a convulsive swallow, she managed to say,
"I doubt that's anatomically possible."
His lips grazed the edge of her jaw.
"You're the medical expert," he mocked gently. "Who am I to argue?"
She squirmed as one of his fingertips wriggled through soft curls and came to rest on an acutely sensitive place.
"Who taught you?"
she managed to ask.
"A woman in Calcutta. I'd never met her before. For the first two nights there was no physical contact at all. We sat on bamboo mats on the floor and talked.
About what? She stared at him with dilated eyes, her flush deepening as he continued to fondle the silky, intricate shape of her.
The first night she explained about karma, a word for desire and longing. But it also refers to the well-being of the soul and senses, the appreciation of beauty, art, nature. The second night we talked about pleasures of the body. She said if a man was a true male, he would use the rule of his will to cherish the woman and fulfill her so thoroughly, she would have no desire left for another.
On the third night, she had undressed him and pulled his hand to her body, whispering, "Women, being of a tender nature, want tender beginnings." That had been the most difficult part for Ethan, showing tenderness to her, to anyone. He'd always feared any kind of weakness in himself. But there had been no choice. He had been committed to doing whatever was necessary to become what Jenkin had intended him to be. This was different. This woman owned the sum of him, his tenderness and violence, everything good or bad. His head lowered over hers, and he kissed her for long, luxurious minutes, learning what made her tremble and her breath come fast. All the while, he let his fingers tickle and play between her thighs. With his thumb and forefinger, he rubbed each fragile inner lip as if releasing perfume from flower petals. She whimpered, her sex nudging upward into his palm. He traced around the swollen bud, close but not touching, and massaged the plump hood just above it.
"Oh, please," Garrett gasped, writhing at the slow torture.
He made the circles smaller, his touch spiralling inward until he reached her clitoris and feathered it with a few light strokes. She moaned, her legs closing on his hips. As her pelvis lifted and froze at the brink of release, he withdrew his touch. She clutched his neck almost angrily, trying to haul him closer.
"Easy now, darling," Ethan said with an uneven laugh, even though he was sweating and aching with his own vicious need. "It won't help you to strangle me."
Her brows lowered, and her fists slid down to grip his vest.
"Why did you stop?"
Ethan lowered his forehead to hers.
"I was taught that satisfying a woman properly should take at least as long as making dough for bread."
Garrett writhed helplessly. "How long is that?"
"You don't know?"
he asked, amused.
"No, I can't cook. How long does it take?"
He let his smiling lips brush her cheek.
"If I told you, you'd probably time me."
Reaching down to part the tender furrow, he caressed her until he felt a touch of wetness. The feel of that silky feminine elixir, coolness and heat, sent a charge of lust through him. He stroked the entrance to her body and insinuated a fingertip. Feeling the tiny muscles clenching to keep him out, he murmured soft words and crooning sounds. Soothering was the Irishman's word for it, and worked carefully deeper. She went motionless at the feeling of being entered, invaded.
"Relax," he whispered, "and I'll be able to reach places that will give you pleasure."
Garrett looked up at him with hazy confusion.
"What places? I've studied reproductive physiology and there are no—"
She broke off with a little yelp as he reached up to her breast and gave the nipple a quick double pinch. Her body tightened around his finger in surprised response. As soon as the inner muscles loosened, he searched more deeply and covered her mouth with his. Her legs spread wider beneath the skirts, her body straining toward him. The depths of her body were fluid and snug, working frantically to pull him in. Drawing his thumb through the gloss of feminine moisture, he caressed the intricate shape of her, teasing and swirling, while his finger began a gentle nudging, mimicking the way he wanted to thrust inside her. His cock was excruciatingly full, as hard as stone, as it pressed against the metal edge of the table. Delving his other hand beneath her skirts, he played with her, fingertips tapping and pattering softly like raindrops. After tracing the slightly distended folds, he tickled between them, grazing the swollen center again and again. No matter how she tried to hurry him, he was relentless and deliberate, stroking slowly, building her pleasure, torturing himself as well as her. Whimpers climbed in her throat. Opening her mouth with his, he licked at the sounds, relishing the way her body shivered and danced at his touch. She was too far gone now to resist the feeling he was giving her, struggling a little, wanting everything faster, harder, closer. But he went even slower, ruthlessly patient and steady, drawing out the tension. The strong pulses began, her flesh wringing out an intense release, her thighs cinching hard on either side of him. Taking her sharp cry into his mouth, he caressed her, worked her, while her head dropped to his shoulder, as if she were too weak to hold it up any longer. She breathed in soft little coos of pleasure and relief, the most delectable sounds he'd ever heard. Eventually, Ethan drew his hands away and wrapped his arms around her.
"I'd love you night and day if I could," he whispered. "There'd be no limits for us, no shame. You and me in the dark, that's all I've ever wanted."
Carefully he slid a hand between them to cup her breast, and kissed it before settling it gently back into the confines of her corset. He did the same with the other side, and began to fasten her bodice. Garrett sat in front of him quietly. When Ethan had finished the last of her buttons, she settled a palm over his heartbeat.
"Come back to me," she whispered. "Find a way to see me."
Ethan held the slim, relaxed weight of her against his chest, and lowered his cheek to her hair.
"I can't."
"You could if you wanted."
"No."
It would have been better to let her think the worst of him, especially after all his reckless indulgence tonight. But he couldn't stand the idea of deceiving her in any way. She was the one person he didn't want to lie to.
"Garrett, I'm about to become a marked man. I've betrayed someone who's been a mentor to me. After he finds out, my life won't be worth a farthing."
Garrett was silent for a moment, toying with a button on his shirt placket. "You mean Sir Jasper?"
"Aye."
"Does it have anything to do with the night at the Guildhall reception? And the man who died, Mr. Prescott?" It was such a good guess that Ethan smiled darkly. Given the chance, he thought, she could pry him open like a tin of sweets. Taking his silence for affirmation, Garrett asked in a neutral tone, "Did you kill him?"
"If I tell you, I'd be putting my life in your hands."
"I'm used to that." It was true, he reflected with a touch of surprise. In all likelihood, she dealt with matters of life and death more often than he did. Staring down into her expectant face, he said slowly,
"I helped to fake his death, and smuggled him out of the country in exchange for information."
"About what?" Ethan hesitated.
"A conspiracy involving government officials. If I succeed in exposing them, God willing, it's worth the cost."
"Not if the cost is your life."
"One man's life isn't important when weighed against many."
"No."
Garrett sounded urgent now, her hand closing on a fold of his shirt. "Every life is worth fighting for."
"It's your job to believe that." "It's my job to believe the opposite. Trust me, I'm expendable."
"Don't say that. Tell me what you're planning to—"
"Garrett,"
he interrupted gently, taking her head in his hands.
"It's not my way to say goodbye. I'll take a kiss instead."
"But—"
Ethan covered her mouth with his. He felt as if he'd been running for thousands of nights through violence and shadows, and had stumbled upon some serene place on a cool spring morning. She had brought him closer to joy than he'd ever been before. But like all moments of surpassing pleasure, it was tempered with a bittersweet awareness of its transience.
"Forget me,"
he whispered, after their lips parted. And he left swiftly, without looking back. The next morning, Garrett emerged from a troubled sleep, and began the day as usual. She woke her father and administered his medicine and had a breakfast of bread, butter and tea while reading the newspaper. As soon as she arrived at the clinic on Cork Street, she checked on the overnight patients, made notes in their charts, gave instructions to the nurses, and began to receive patients with scheduled appointments. On the surface, everything was routine, but underneath, she was miserable, giddy, and shamed all at once. The effort to regulate herself was exhausting. Would she ever see Ethan Ransom again? How in God's name was she supposed to forget him after the things he'd done to her? Every time she thought of those knowing masculine hands, the slow kisses and soft whispers, she wanted to melt to the floor. You and me, in the dark. That's all I've ever wanted. Thinking about him could drive her mad if she let it. Nothing went right. The way the nurses trilled, "Good morning!" set her teeth on edge. The medical supply cabinets and closets were disorganized. The staff talked too loudly in the hallways and common rooms. At lunchtime, she ate at the staff commissary, and the cheerful bustle she usually enjoyed was profoundly irritating. Oblivious to the conversation around her, she picked morosely at an artful arrangement of cold sliced chicken, watercress and cucumber salad, and a tiny dish of cherry tapioca. There were more patient appointments in the afternoon, some correspondence and bill paying, and then it was time to return home. Glum and weary, Garrett descended from the hansom, walked up to her front door, and paused to look at it with a bewildered frown. The familiar nameplate was still there, but a heavy bronze mortise lock had replaced the old, outdated one. There was a new cast bronze doorknob, and a lion's head knocker, its jaws clamped on a heavy ring. Unlike the standard snarling, squinty-eyed design, this lion looked rather friendly and sociable. The door's casing had been repaired and reinforced. Old hinges had been replaced with sturdy new ones. A draught-proof weather strip had been added to the bottom edge of the door. Hesitantly, Garrett reached for the door knocker. The ring hit the handsome engraved bronze backplate with a satisfying clack. Before she could continue knocking, the door opened smoothly, and a beaming Eliza took her bag and cane. "Evening, Dr. Gibson. Look at this door. It's the finest one in King's Cross, I'll warrant." "Who did it?" Garrett managed to ask, following her into the house. Eliza looked puzzled. "Didn't you hire a locksmith?" "I most certainly did not." Garrett removed her gloves and hat and gave them to her. "What name did he give? When did he come?" "This morning, after you left. I took your father out for a constitutional in the park. We were gone no more than an hour, but when we came back there was a man working on the door. I didn't ask his name. He and Mr. Gibson exchanged a few pleasantries while he was finishing up, and gave us a set of steel keys and left." "Was it the man from last night, my patient?" "No. This one was old, grey-haired and stoop-shouldered. A strange man let himself into the house and changed the lock, and neither you nor my father asked for his name?" Garrett asked with an incredulous scowl. "Good God, Eliza, he could have robbed us blind." "I thought you knew about it," the cookmaid protested, following her into the surgery. Anxiously, Garrett went to see if any of her supplies or equipment were missing. Nothing appeared to have been disturbed. Folding back the partition to her laboratory, she checked to make certain her microscope was safely in its case. Turning, she ran her gaze over the shelves of supplies and froze. The dozen glass test tubes in the wooden rack had been filled with violets. The blue petals were as vivid as jewels in the utilitarian environment. An intoxicating scent drifted from the row of tiny bouquets. "Where did these come from?" Eliza asked, standing beside her. "Our mysterious locksmith must have left them as a prank." Garrett removed one of the blossoms and touched it to her cheek and lips. Her fingers were trembling. "Now my test tubes are all contaminated," she said, trying to sound cross. "Dr. Gibson, are you about to cry?" "Of course not," Garrett said indignantly. "You know I never do that. Your face is all red, your eyes are watery. An inflammatory reaction. I'm hypersensitive to violets." Eliza looked alarmed. "Shall I toss them for you?" "No." She cleared her throat and spoke more softly. No, I want to keep them.
Is everything all right, Doctor?
Garrett let out a slow breath and tried to reply in a normal tone.
I'm just tired, Eliza. Nothing to worry about.
There was no one she could confide in. For Ethan's sake, she had to stay silent. She would do as he'd asked and forget him. He was only a man. The world was full of men. She would find another one.
A good, decent husband, of the old stock, who'd give you a fair sale of children.
Would Ethan ever want children? Would she? There was no logical reason for her to have children or marry at all, but she was astonished to realize it was something she might consider. A humbling thought occurred to her. When you meet the right man, the list of things you would never do suddenly becomes much shorter.
Chapter 9. The door to Jenkins's office had been left slightly ajar. Ethan paused to knock on the jamb, trying to remain outwardly relaxed, despite the weight of foreboding in the pit of his stomach. His ability to shut away his emotions, one of his most useful assets, had disappeared. He was all exposed nerves and raw appetite. He felt as transparent as glass, and there were too many lies he had to keep straight. He'd been like this for the past week, ever since the night he'd spent with Garrett Gibson. The thought of her was deep inside him, at the centre of every thought and sensation, as if he existed only as a vessel to contain her. Life had been a damn sight easier when he had had nothing to lose. It was killing him not to go to her. The only thing that stopped him was the need to keep her safe.
"Enter," came Jenkins's relaxed voice.
Ethan let himself inside. He'd come into the new government building by way of the back entrance used by servants and junior clerks. Even without the need for discretion, he would have preferred that to going through the brazenly elaborate main entrance and reception rooms, with their plasterwork thickly coated in gilt, and the stands of marble columns rising from lapis floors. Ethan found it suffocating. The ostentatious interiors were intended to proclaim the power and grandeur of an empire that ruled almost one quarter of the Earth's surface, and refused to yield even an inch of its territory. It had been at Jenkins's insistence that the collection of contiguous offices under the roof of the newest building at Whitehall had all been shut off from each other. The Home Office kept all connecting doors perpetually locked, so no one could walk from there directly to the Foreign Office, India Office, or Colonial Office. Instead, visitors had to go down into the street, walk the outside length of the building, and ascend another staircase. Free communication between offices would have made Jenkins's scheming and plotting more difficult. The corner office provided a view of a nearby building that had originally contained a cockfighting pit. Ethan suspected Jenkins would have preferred it if the cockpit still existed. He was the kind of man who enjoyed blood sports. The air was hot enough to braise a plucked cap on. Jenkins always kept a fire lit, even in summer. The spymaster cut an elegant figure, his build long and stiletto-thin, as he occupied one of two heavy leather smoking chairs positioned in front of the fireplace. Orange flickers played over his thinning blonde hair and austere features, as he regarded Ethan through distal spirals of cigar smoke. His eyes were a shade of cinnamon brown that should have appeared warm, but somehow never did.
"Ransom," he said pleasantly, nudging a tabletop cigar stand toward him. "We have much to discuss this evening."
Ethan hated the taste of tobacco, but a cigar from Jenkins was a mark of favour that no one refused. As he sat, he took a cigar from the carved ebony stand. Conscious of the older man's attentive regard, he performed the ritual with care. Jenkins had always emphasised the importance of details. A gentleman knew how to light a cigar, how to sit on a horse, how to make introductions properly.
"You'll never pass for a born gentleman," Jenkins had once told him, "but you'll at least be able to mix with your betters without calling attention to yourself."
After clipping the end of a cigar with an engraved silver cutter, Ethan lit a long match and toasted the outer binding. He put it to his lips, rotating it slowly while igniting the filler, and released the drawer expertly. Jenkins smiled, something he rarely did, perhaps out of the awareness that his smiles gave the impression of a feeding predator.
"Let's attend to business. Did you meet with Felbrigg?"
"Yes, sir."
"What's got his back up this time?"
Jenkin asked disdainfully. There was a vicious rivalry between Jenkin and Fred Felbrigg, the commissioner of the Metropolitan Police. Jenkin and his 8 secret servicemen had become direct competition for Felbrigg and his team of a half-dozen plainclothes, active officers. Jenkin treated Scotland Yard with open contempt, refusing to collaborate or share intelligence. He had said publicly that London police were incompetent, a pack of fools. Instead of using them for extra manpower, Jenkin had sent for Royal Irish constables from Dublin. To add insult to injury, Jenkin's position at the Home Office wasn't even legal. He and the Secret Service force had never been approved by Parliament. One could hardly blame Scotland Yard and Fred Felbrigg for being livid. However, Jenkin acquired power as easily as breathing. His influence extended everywhere, even to distant foreign ports and consulates. He had created an international web of spies, agents, and informers, all answerable to no one but him.
"Felbrigg complains that he hasn't seen any embassy intelligence in a year," Ethan said. "He says the information goes directly from the consulates to you, and you haven't shared a word of it."
Jenkin looked smug.
"When the national security is at stake, I have the authority to do as I see fit." "Felbrigg is going to meet with the Commissioner and the Home Secretary to take up the matter with them." "The idiot. Does he think it would do any good to whine in front of them like a schoolboy?"
"He'll do more than whine,"
Ethan said.
"He says he has intelligence that proves you're endangering British citizens by withholding crucial information."
Jenkin gave him a look that could have peeled a turnip.
"What intelligence?" "A report that a schooner bound from Le Havre to London sailed 2 days ago, carrying 8 tons of dynamite and 20 cases of fuse. Felbrigg is going to tell the Commissioner and the Home Secretary that you were aware of it, but kept it yourself."
Ethan paused, taking a gentle pull on the cigar, and exhaling a stream of smoke before continuing tonelessly.
"The London Port Police weren't even warned, and now the cargo has mysteriously disappeared. My own men are handling it. The Port Police don't need to know. They would bungle what's been set in motion."
A short pause.
"Who sent the information to Felbrigg?" "A port official from Le Havre. I want his name." "Yes, sir."
In the silence that followed, Ethan was grateful for the cigar. A prop that gave him something to do, something to look at and fiddle with. Jenkin had always been able to read him so accurately that it was well nigh impossible to hide anything from him. It was all Ethan could do to keep from confronting him about the missing dynamite. The bastard was planning to do something evil with it, and the knowledge sickened and enraged him. But there was another part of Ethan's heart that grieved. He and Jenkin had formed a bond over the past 6 years, a young man who'd needed a mentor, and an older one who'd wanted someone to mould in his image. Deliberately, Ethan focused his thoughts on the early years when he'd worshipped Jenkin, who had seemed to be the fount of all knowledge and wisdom. There had been endless training from various instructors, intelligence gathering, combat and firearms, burglary, sabotage, survival skills, wireless telegraphy, codes and ciphers. But there had also been days Jenkin had spent with him personally, instructing him about things like wine tasting, etiquette, how to play cards, how to mingle with upper-class toffs. He had been fatherly. Ethan remembered the day Jenkin had taken him to a Savile Row tailor, where a referral from a well-established client was required before one could become a customer.
"Always have your waistcoats made with 4 pockets, Jenkin had told him, seeming amused by Ethan's wonder and excitement at putting on tailored clothes for the first time. "This upper side pocket is for railway tickets and a latchkey. The other side is for loose sovereigns. The lower pockets are for a timepiece, a handkerchief, and banknotes. Remember, a gentleman never keeps paper money in the same pocket as coins."
That memory, and countless others, kindled a sense of gratitude that even 8 tons of missing dynamite couldn't entirely destroy. Ethan held on to the feeling deliberately, letting it soften him. He heard Jenkins' dry voice.
Aren't you going to ask what I've done with the explosives?
Ethan lifted his head and stared at him steadily, smiling slightly.
No, sir.
Seeming reassured, Jenkins settled more deeply in his chair.
Good lad, he murmured.
Ethan hated the momentary glow the words gave him.
We see the world the same way, you and I, the older man continued. Most people can't bring themselves to face the ugly reality that some lives must be sacrificed for the greater good.
That sounded like the explosives would be used for another terrorism plot. Something similar to what had been planned for the Guildhall.
What if some of the victims turn out to be Englishmen? Ethan asked. Don't be obtuse, my boy. Our own people have to be targeted. The more prominent, the better. If the Guildhall plot had succeeded, it would have shocked and angered the entire nation. Public opinion would have turned against the Irish radicals who dared to attack innocent British citizens, and it would have ended any question of Ireland's independence.
But Irish radicals weren't responsible, Ethan said slowly.
We were.
I would call it a joint enterprise. Jenkins tapped the ash from his cigar into a crystal tray.
I assure you, there's no shortage of Irish political insurgents who are more than willing to resort to violence. And if we don't continue to assist their efforts, some lunatic bill on home rule may eventually become law.
As he drew in another mouthful of smoke, the end of the cigar glowed like a malevolent red eye.
Anyone who thinks the Irish are capable of governing themselves is as mad as a bedbug. They're a brutish race that respects no law.
They would respect the law more if it didn't fall so hard on them, Ethan couldn't resist saying. The Irish are taxed higher than the English, in return for only half the justice. Duty is hard when there's no back of fairness to it.
Jenkins blew out a stream of smoke.
You're right, of course, he said after a moment. Even the strongest opponents of home rule can't claim that Ireland has been ruled justly. However, Irish independence isn't the answer. The damage it would do to the Empire is incalculable. Our only concern is what's best for England's interests.
You know I love the Queen and country,
Ethan said flippantly. Undeceived, Jenkins studied him closely.
Does it weigh on your conscience that innocent lives will be lost as a result of our efforts?
Ethan gave him a sardonic glance.
I have no more use for a conscience than I do for neckties. I may have to wear one in public, but I don't bother with one in private.
Jenkins chuckled.
This week I want you to help gamble with some security arrangements. It's for a charity event at the Home Secretary's private residence. A number of MPs and Cabinet Ministers will attend. With all the recent political unrest, one can't be too careful.
Ethan's pulse quickened. More than anywhere else in the world, the London house occupied by Lord Tatham, the Home Secretary, was the place he most wanted access. But he frowned at the mention of William Gable, a fellow Secret Service agent who would have been perfectly willing to shoot him on command. Jenkins often liked to play them against each other, like a pair of bull terriers bred for the pit.
Security isn't Gamble's strong suit, Ethan said. I'd rather make the arrangements by myself.
I've already put him in charge. Follow the procedures he lays out, to the letter. I want you to focus on the exterior of the house and provide Gamble with an analysis of any landscape features or structures that might pose a risk.
Ethan sent him a mutinous glance, but didn't argue.
You'll both attend the event, Jenkins continued. And, of course, you'll keep your eyes and ears open. Gamble will pose as an under-butler.
And me? Ethan asked warily.
You'll be a speculative builder from Durham.
That placated Ethan slightly. He might enjoy lording it over Gamble a bit at the event. However, Jenkins' next remarks extinguished the flicker of satisfaction.
As an enterprising young man about town, you would likely be escorting an eligible lady to the soiree. It would make your guise more believable. Perhaps we should find someone to accompany you. An attractive and accomplished woman, but not one so high-born as to be beyond your reach.
There was no specific threat in the words, but they caused a swooping plummet of his stomach. Without even thinking, he began to regulate his breathing in the way the guru in India had taught him. Let each breath flow smoothly. Four counts in, four counts out.
I don't know any ladies, he said calmly.
Is that so? He heard Jenkin ask, affecting mild surprise. I was under the impression that lately you've been keeping company with quite an interesting lady, Dr. Garrett Gibson.
Now Ethan's stomach no longer felt like it was swooping. It felt like it had crashed through a window and was plummeting in a shower of broken glass. Any time Jenkin was sufficiently aware of a fellow human being to mention his or her name, their lifespan became statistically shorter. Somewhere within the iced-over machinery of his brain, he registered that Jenkin was speaking again.
Never stab the end of a good cigar, Ransom. It doesn't deserve a violent death. Let it burn out with dignity.
You haven't answered my question.
Ethan looked down at the collapsed foot of his cigar, which he hadn't even been aware of crushing into the ashtray. As the flood of ruined smoke bit inside his nostrils, he asked tonelessly,
What question?
Obviously, I would like you to tell me about your relationship with Dr. Gibson.
Ethan's face felt stiff, as if it had been covered in plaster and left to dry.
He needed to produce a smile, something that looked genuine, and he searched frantically through the chaos of his thoughts until the phrase, scrotal chafing, came to mind. That was enough to help him crack a grin. Relaxing back in his chair, he lifted his gaze to Jenkins, and saw a hint of surprise at his self-possession.
Good. There's no relationship, Ethan said easily. Who told you there was?
The older man ignored the question. You've been following Dr. Gibson to the Clerkenwell area. You accompanied her to a special evening market and visited her home afterward. What would you call that?
I was trifling with her.
It required the full force of Ethan's wit to remain calm, as he realized he'd been shadowed, almost certainly by another agent. Probably Gamble, the disloyal prick.
Dr. Gibson is not the kind of woman one trifles with, Jenkins said. She's unique. The only female in the entire British medical profession. What does it take to achieve that? Superior powers of mind, a cool disposition, and courage equal to any man's. If that weren't enough, she's reportedly quite pleasing to the eye, a beauty, even. Regarded as a saint in some circles, a she-demon in others. You must be fascinated by her.
She's a curiosity, is all.
Oh, come, Jenkins said with amused chiding. She's a good deal more than that. Even Dr. Gibson's sharpest detractors won't deny that she's extraordinary.
Ethan shook his head.
She has a high way with her, hard as flint. I'm not displeased by your interest in her, my boy. Quite the opposite. You've always said women are a distraction.
So they are. However, I've never asked you to live like a monk. A man's natural passions are meant to be exercised in moderation. Prolonged celibacy makes the constitution irritable.
I'm not irritable, Ethan snapped, and I'm no more interested in Dr. Gibson than I am in staring at a bucket of dirt.
Jenkin appeared to suppress a smile. Thou dost protest too much.
Seeing Ethan's lack of comprehension, he asked, Haven't you read the copy of Hamlet I gave to you?
I didn't finish it, Ethan muttered.
The older man was obviously displeased.
Why not? Hamlet spends all his time talking. He never does anything. It's a revenge play with no revenge.
How do you know if you haven't finished it?
Ethan shrugged. I don't care how it ends.
The play is about a man who's forced to face the reality of human depravity. He lives in a fallen world in which right and wrong is whatever he decides. There is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. I assumed you would have enough imagination to put yourself in Hamlet's place.
If I were in his place, Ethan said sullenly, I'd do more than stand around making speeches.
Jenkin regarded him with a touch of fond paternal exasperation. Something in that interested, caring look pierced down to the place in Ethan's heart that had always yearned for a father. And it hurt.
The play is a mirror held up to a man's soul, Jenkins said. Read the rest of it, and tell me about the reflection you see.
The last thing Ethan wanted to see was the reflection of his own soul. God help him! It might look far too similar to the man sitting across from him.
but there was his mother's influence. More and more often of late, Ethan had found himself thinking about her shame at the sins her circumstances had obliged her to commit, and her hopes that he would grow up to be a good man. She turned to religion near the end of her life, and had worried constantly about salvation, not only her own, but also her son's. She had died of cholera not long after Ethan had joined K Division. One of Ethan's last memories of his mother was how she'd wept with pride upon first seeing him in the blue uniform. She thought it would be the saving of him. Oh, how she would have hated Sir Jasper Jenkin.
"As for Dr. Gibson," Jenkin continued, "my compliments on your taste. A woman with a brain will keep you interested out of bed as well as in it."
If Jenkin thought Ethan cared for Garrett, he would use her as a pawn to manipulate him. She might be threatened or harmed. She might simply disappear one day, as if into thin air, never to be seen again unless Ethan did whatever unspeakable thing Jenkin wanted of him.
"I prefer a woman who's easy for the taking and easy to discard," Ethan said curtly. "Unlike Dr. Gibson."
"Not at all," came Jenkin's softly chilling reply. "As you and I are both aware, Ransom, anyone can be discarded."
Leaving Whitehall on foot, Ethan headed north and cut across to the Victoria Embankment, a road and river walk along the Thames. The new roadway along the granite-faced embankment had been expected to ease the crush of daytime traffic along Charing Cross, Fleet Street and the Strand, but it seemed to have made no appreciable difference. At night, however, the embankment was comparatively quiet. Occasional puffs of smoke or steam rising through the iron ventilation grids reminded pedestrians of the subterranean world beneath their feet. Tunnels, telegraph wires, underground railways, and pipes for gas and water. Wandering near a coal and forage wharf, Ethan reached a maze of alleys crowded with excavating equipment and temporary contractors' workshops. He slipped behind a massive stone-channeling machine and waited. In less than 2 minutes, a dark figure entered the alley. As Ethan had expected, it was Gamble. The lean, wolfish face and sharp brow were distinctive even in the shadows. Like Ethan, he was tall but not so towering that he would stand out in a crowd. With his big arms and bulldog chest, he carried most of his power in his upper torso. There were many things to admire about William Gamble, but very little to like. He was physically adept and aggressive, able to tolerate brutal punishment and keep coming back for more. His tenacity had driven him to train harder than any of Jenkins's men. He never complained or made excuses, never exaggerated or boasted. Those were all qualities Ethan respected. But Gamble had been born into a coal mining family in Newcastle, and the desperate poverty of his childhood had engendered a ferocity that burned out any softer qualities. He had come to revere Jenkin with an intensity that verged on zealotry. There was no sentiment in him, no trace of empathy, which Ethan had once judged as a strength, but had turned out to be a weakness. Gamble tended to miss the fiddly little clues and signals that people unconsciously gave away in conversation. As a result, he didn't always ask the right questions, and often misinterpreted the answers. Keeping still, Ethan watched Gamble come farther into the space between the shreds. He waited until Gamble's back was turned, and sprang from behind, fast as a striking cobra. Hooking the bend of his arm around the thick neck, Ethan jerked the man back against his chest. Ignoring Gamble's violent writhing, he gripped his own left bicep and fitted his hand against the back of the man's head to increase the pressure of the choke. The combination of pain and oxygen deprivation worked in a matter of seconds. Gamble submitted, going still. In a quietly vicious tone, Ethan asked near his ear, "How long have you been reporting on me to Jenkin?"
"Weeks," Gamble gasped, clutching at the arm around his throat. "You made it easy, sodding idiot."
"An idiot who's about to crush your larynx."
Ethan slowly tightened his arm against the trachea.
"You've put an innocent woman at risk. If anything happens to her, I'll beat the marrow out of you and hang you up like salted pork."
Straining to breathe, Gamble didn't reply. For a moment, the urge to finish him off was nearly overpowering. It would be so easy to constrict his grip a few degrees more and prolong the hold until the bastard was properly throttled. Uttering a low curse, Ethan released him with an abrupt shove. Wheezing, Gamble pivoted to face him.
"If anything happens to her," he retorted hoarsely, "it will be your fault. Did you think Jenkin wouldn't find out? Someone else would have told him if I hadn't."
"You're as daft as a rock if you think Jenkin will like you better for turning into a snitch."
Seeing Gamble's defensive posture, his muscles tensed to fend off an attack. Ethan said sardonically,
"If I were going to kill you, I'd have done it already."
"You should have."
"I'm not the enemy," Ethan said in exasperation. "Why in God's name are you wasting time and effort fighting me?"
"Eliminate a rival without mercy," Gamble quoted, "or one day he'll try to replace you."
Ethan snorted, unimpressed.
"Parroting Jenkin makes you sound more of a lackwit than you already are.
As long as I've known Jenkin, he's never been wrong about anything. Before we left for India, he predicted that someday one of us would kill the other. I told him I would be the last man standing."
Ethan smiled without humour.
"He said the same thing to me. I told him to kiss my arse. Jenkin's a manipulative bastard. Why should you and I turn into a pair of dancing monkeys every time he winds up the barrel organ?"
"Because that's a job."
Ethan shook his head slowly.
"No, Gamble," he said, his voice pure acid. "Because we each want to be his favourite. He chose us because he knew we could do anything, no matter how vile, to win his approval. But I've had enough of it. 'Tis not a job, but a deal with the devil. I'm not a well-read man, but I have the impression those never turn out well."
It had been a dreadful week. Garrett had gone through each day in a mechanical fashion, feeling bleak and empty. Food had no flavour, flowers had no scent. Her eyes were itchy and sore from lack of sleep. She couldn't pay attention to anyone or anything. It seemed the rest of her life would be an infinity of monotonous days. The lowest moment had occurred on Tuesday evening, when Garrett had gone on her usual visit to the Clerkenwell workhouse, and afterwards had dared to blow a short, hopeful little summons on her silver whistle. There had been no response. Even if Ethan were somewhere nearby keeping an eye on her, he wasn't going to come to her. The realisation that she would probably never see him again had plunged her into a sullen void. Her father hadn't understood the reason for her low spirits, but he had assured her that everyone had a fit of the doldrums sooner or later. The best cure, he'd said, was to spend time with cheerful people.
"Is there a second choice?" Garrett had asked dully. "Because at the moment, the only thing I'd like to do with cheerful people is push them into the path of an oncoming carriage."
However, the following morning, Garrett was finally able to feel something other than gloom. It was during an appointment with one of the clinic's new patients, a watchmaker's wife named Mrs. Notley, who had given birth 8 months earlier and feared she might be with child again. After examining her, Garrett gave her the welcome news that she was not expecting. "None of the various evidences of pregnancy are there," she told Mrs. Notley. "Although your worry is understandable, it's not uncommon for a woman's monthly courses to be irregular while her infant is still nursing." Mrs. Notley was overcome with relief.
"Praise God!" she exclaimed, dabbing at her eyes with a handkerchief. "My husband and I didn't know what we were going to do. We have four little ones already and can't afford another so soon. We live in constant dread of when the next baby might come."
"What method of prevention do you use?" The woman blushed and looked uncomfortable at Garrett's frankness.
"We count the days after my monthly turn."
"Does your husband practice withdrawal?"
"Oh, no, doctor. Our pastor says it's a sin for a man to do that outside his wife's body."
"Have you thought of contraception, such as douches or sponges?" Garrett asked. Mrs. Notley looked aghast.
"That's against nature."
A wave of impatience swept over Garrett, but she managed to keep her expression pleasant.
"Nature must occasionally be prevented from having its way, or we should have no inventions such as running water or lace-up shoes. As modern women, we need not produce more offspring than we can adequately feed, clothe, and raise to be satisfactory adults. Let me tell you about some safe options that will reduce the chances of an unwanted pregnancy.
No, thank you.
Garrett's brows drew together.
May I ask why not?